Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening. This week's episode is sponsored by Watchman Monitoring. Visit watchmanmonitoring.com/commandcontrolpower and let Watchman Monitoring be the backbone of your proactive support services. So just one thing occurred to me the other day. When you guys work on systems that are so slow, like this, they've got a spinning disk, you know, and they're so slow that they leave you wondering, why did I open system preferences? You know, because it's like you open it and then you're like, oh my God, it's still jumping. All right. Like you go and do something else and it's like minutes go by and the thing loads and you're like, I don't even remember why I opened it. You know, was it something in accounts? Was it an energy saver? Was it like sharing? It could be anything, you know, at that point. Was it internet account?
So is this your Cario email server in the office, Joe? Is this what you're talking about?
The entire operation is running on this machine. No, it's just those client machines where they're like, I can't believe you still haven't upgraded. You know, you're running a 2009 iMac with a spinning disk that's never been replaced or anything. And I don't know how to people tolerate that. They open up mail and it's like, in 5 minutes or so, I'll be able to send you that email. You know, like, just give me a few more minutes. You know, it's like, that's crazy. People get used to stuff like that. It just drives me crazy working on that.
Oh, that's agreed. And the other thing too is anytime you touch that machine, you're on borrowed time. Tag, you're it. And all of a sudden the machine massively fails and you were the last person to sit in front of it.
Right.
We've all been there.
Yep, we have. The other thing I wanted to give everybody a PSA about, have you ever tried to create an iCloud.com email address? A client wants to start using an iCloud.com address. So you just want to go in and like create a new iCloud account, starting with a new Apple ID.
I think I know where you're going with this. Brand I want to hear
iCloud
this.
Account, yep. The scenario I was in, it was a client said, you know, I just want an address I can use for like whatever throwaway purpose, blah, blah, blah. And I said, she said, what about an iCloud.com account? I said, sure, you know, why not? Like, you know, you're our big Apple user. It's sure. Why not just use it for email? So in this case, we were on her Mac. So I was remoted into her Mac. I created a new user account, reconnected, you know, logged into that user account and reconnected and went into fresh user account, iCloud preference, and chose to create a new Apple ID for iCloud. You know, you go through these steps. Okay, what's your birthday? Uncomfortable conversation with your female client. You know, what's your birthday? She, you know, puts in her birthday and she makes a joke about it, whatever. So you move on from there. And then you go through like, you know, your basic information, your security questions, all these things, even to the point where you select the Apple ID, you choose an address, it's available at iCloud.com. Finally, the very end, right, when it's like, you're going to create the account now, I kept getting this undefined error message. There was no description. It was very un-Apple-like, in fact. I don't think there was a number, it was just error and then undefined. We went through that whole process twice, and I'm like, I don't know, this is crazy. We restarted, we tried it again. Couldn't figure it out. Of course, since it was an undefined error message, I'm like, I don't really even know where to go from here. I tried another computer. So I had her old computer for some other work we were doing on it on the bench. So I grabbed that computer in the office and did the same thing, created a new user account, went through all the steps. I had all her information that she wanted at this point. So I just put in all the info, got the same undefined error message. So I'm like, two different computers, the same problem. What had occurred to me, the reason I tried a second machine is that I think there's a limit. I don't think it's a written limit, but I've heard about it, that you can only create 3 Apple IDs on any given computer, brand new Apple IDs. You can't just, you know, grab a Mac and create some unlimited number of iCloud addresses. And Sam, you might know this from training, right? There's cases where you have to create Apple IDs for a bunch of people at once, and there's like a way to do that that's not through this process because you can't, you're limited, right? Is that related or no?
Mine was more related to your IP gets blacklisted.
Okay. So the IP, yeah. So my understanding is like even iPhone, Mac, whatever, let's say you inherit a Mac from somebody, I'm pretty sure that if they've like already created 3 different iCloud addresses on that device, you won't even be able to create a new one on that Mac. It's just like a hardware limit. It must be associated with a serial number, that or Mac address. So I was thinking that, and that's why I tried a second Mac and it was the same message. And I'm like, this is crazy. let's try your iPhone. I walk her through the steps there, and I felt silly because I'm like, well, I'm trying to save you trouble by doing this remotely, and you know, now I have to tell you what to do. Go here, click here, tap here, whatever. So I walked her through it, and she got to this final step of doing it on an iPhone, and it gives an error message that you can't create an Apple ID at iCloud.com starting with a number. So the iPhone error message was defined, and that's what it said. So, you know, sure enough, we've been trying to use this address that she was choosing this whole time. And I don't know why I've never encountered this before, but it was something like 123 any street at iCloud.com. It was like similar to like an address or whatever. So it had started with a number. That was the message from the iPhone. So at least we knew now what the error was. So for like spending a half hour trying to do this, we just started over and she made up a new address. And sure enough, it worked just fine. Not starting with a number, starting with a letter.
Wow, that's wacky, man. I have not seen that one before.
Yeah. So little PSA to save you some time. If you're banging your head against the wall from a Mac and you're not getting the error message, you don't know why it's not working. That's why. It's got to start with a letter. Thanks to the iPhone error message, we know that. One of those things where I wish I could like help Apple out. I'm not really sure where to submit that feedback. I guess it's like probably a Mac OS, just general feedback to say like, hey, this error message is undefined in this probably one very weird edge case.
Circling back to what you said, I mean, this is all fascinating to me. Are you restricted in creating Apple IDs on a specific Mac? And I default to the trainer, who should be able to give us a definitive answer right now in this show.
Jeez, that's pressure. But you don't need me. Joe was absolutely right. It's the 3 Apple ID limit on a particular piece of hardware.
Now, how is that identified? Is that through the MAC address on the device, or is it hard-coded into the logic board, some sort of identification that they're looking at? What are they looking at to...
That I don't know. I'm assuming serial number, but I don't know for sure.
That would be true, that if you bought a used machine, you could be locked out.
You could get screwed, yeah, trying to create a new Apple ID.
Well, that's absolutely bizarre. I mean, I'm surprised that more people aren't complaining about this or you don't hear more about this.
You know, you think about the computer's lifespan and people that would get a computer that would actually need to create a new one as opposed to just signing in. But yeah, it kind of, if you think about it, it's like, wow, how come we don't get more calls about this? But
right. The other thing, too, is what Joe described. Of course, you know, the only way to create a new Apple ID is to create a new account on a Mac and then log into that and then create the Apple ID. I mean, that's so draconian, too, if you think about it. You know, there should be some other way to do it other than having to just create a dummy account and then create it.
By locking it to a device, like, you know, you have to create it using a device. Obviously, it's in Apple's interest to do that, to limit the number of addresses that people claim and then make so they're unavailable to other people. In theory, it would help make iCloud.com addresses more available. And of course, those are all pretty limited at this point anyway, given how many people are using Macs and iPhones. So tying it to a machine does let them do this kind of thing where they're limiting the number that can be created on any given machine, and therefore the total accounts that people can create. I guess there's probably a way to spoof the serial number. I'm sure there's a way to work around this, I would imagine. I mean, maybe not. Maybe it's very secure, but we haven't ever encountered it because I think, yeah, like to your point, Sam, it's like you don't create that many accounts. Maybe when a family switches from Windows to Mac and everybody needs a new iCloud address, but then they're going to have new devices that they can each use. So it's like 3 per device. If you've hit the limit on one device, you just use a different device and you can get around it. So it also occurs to me like not to use my own personal computer to create an iCloud account for somebody because I don't want to hit that limit, you know, on my own machines.
And don't worry, sometime in the near future, they're going to come out with IPv6 iCloud email addresses. And then we'll have infinite numbers of email addresses we could create with iCloud.
Right, exactly.
Exactly.
Do you have a developer account by chance?
I think I still do. I'm not sure.
Because Apple has a bug reporter that I know in the past, at least, I think you needed a developer account to sign in. And if you wanted to submit that bug.
Yeah. My answer to that always is, will I get paid for this? I love that when software companies are like, well, if you want, you know, you could write in and, you know, tell us how we can make our software better. What do you... No, I'm not going to do that. Are you going to pay me?
You don't want to be a team player, Jerry?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things. It's like, read something online. It saves me a ton of trouble. And I'm like, man, I really need to like contribute more. When I find a solution, like go post it on that original thread that didn't have the solution. And who has time for that? But at the same time, we put out a fair amount of information on the show. So I think we kind of do our fair share, I guess. I mean, it'd be great to be able to go in and always follow and close those loops. Who has time for it?
Exactly.
Not me.
Joe, you want to tell us about that black hat device there you got on your bench that you can reset?
Actually, I don't know if I do. That was the next topic on my list. The way you just put it makes me think, I don't know, do we really want to ruin this for everybody? But
aren't you on the ACN council too?
Yeah, I mean, have I agreed not to spread the word about this kind of tool? But anyway, yeah, let's talk about it. We've already teased it enough here. So to set the stage, we had a MacBook Pro 13-inch Retina, 2015, I think it was, come in to us with a cracked screen. The client did not want to proceed with the repair. I can't remember exactly why. I think it was just like more expensive to repair this display than they wanted to go ahead with. And so we said, this machine has a value to it. We can repair it and repurpose it and has a fair market value. And so we made them an offer and we said, we'll give you, you know, X amount for this hardware just as is, you know, damaged screen and whatever else was wrong. They agreed to it. So we bought this computer with this bad display. We ended up swapping parts with another Mac that came in. I think the other Mac needed a logic board. And so we took the perfect logic board out of this Mac and put it in that MacBook Pro 13-inch Retina 2015. And basically did the repair. So we were already able to sort of like part out this machine to sell the logic board, the used logic board to this other client and make a working Mac out of it. So now this Mac ended up having this bad logic and cracked display. We decided, let's see if we can fix this. It's a 2015 MacBook Pro. It's a decent model. Let's get it working and repurpose it for our own use. And so needed a new display. Turned out it was a liquid spill on the other computer. So now it has a liquid spill problem with this logic board. So Nate, our technician here, took it apart, figured out that a few of the keys needed to be replaced. Rather than replacing the entire top case, he figured out that you could actually just replace the keyboard. So we ordered, he told me what to order. It's like a 50 screw kit. So you buy these like 50 keyboard screws. And I'm like, that sounds to me like an absolute nightmare. But he's like, sure, I'll replace these 50 screws and replace the keyboard. You're not supposed to be able to like actually replace the keyboard. It's not a replaceable part, but you can actually pop the rivets that hold the keys in place and replace them with these 50 screws. And they're like self-threading. So essentially like you pop the old keyboard out and then you put the new keyboard in and screw these 50 screws in. And now you have a replacement keyboard. Don't think we would do this for a client. Probably we would do it the correct way, but this was just for our own use and we did it and it worked. So he replaced the keyboard. Now we have a functioning keyboard. The logic board, I'm pretty sure he was able to just sort of clean up the liquid spill on the logic board. So aside from the keyboard, it had very little damage. Maybe it needed a DC inboard or something like that. So it was very minor, like hardware parts to replace it. But we get to the point where now it has a display that's been fixed. It has a working keyboard and the logic board's all working, except it's locked, iCloud and a firmware lock. And that was because we just took this logic board out of some, you know, machine that was basically just had a liquid spill and we were just replacing it in that other case. So we weren't aware that the client had locked it to their iCloud account. We got the machine to boot. Everything's working well. The keyboard's working fine. Now we're stuck at the iCloud lock screen with prompting for this four-digit code. We did some research. Again, Nate did this research and found that there's a way to reset the iCloud lock, the four-digit code, to determine what the four-digit code is. There's a couple methods that he found. I'm not going to link to this stuff, but there were a few methods found to break through that iCloud lock on the login screen. One of the methods either didn't work in this one case or no longer works at all or whatever, but there was another method that did allow that part to be bypassed. But we were still stuck with a firmware password. We're thinking, okay, given the fact that this is a machine that's cobbled together from several different computers, I don't really want to go into the Apple store and try to prove our ownership of it. It just would seem awkward and weird. Like, where did we get this computer? It's assigned to like whose name? And so I didn't really want to go through that normal sort of channel to reset the firmware password. And of course, listeners who go way back will remember you used to be able just to remove RAM and then zap the PRAM, and then that would reset the open firmware password. And you can't do it with a, you know, Retina MacBook Pro, of course. There's no way to remove RAM. So the only way to reset a firmware password that's sanctioned is to bring it into the Apple store and prove your identity and your ownership of it. So we didn't want to do that. Again, Nate did a little bit more research and found this tool, finally, to get to the punchline here. It's called the Mac EFI tool. It will allow you to reset a firmware password. Kadentech.com, KadenTech.com. Tool that we purchased is called the Mac EFI tool. And what it is, it just sounds so insane. I can't even believe we tried this and it worked. You attach this circuit board, it clips on top of the firmware chip. You open up the MacBook Pro, exposing the logic board. you clip this really weird thing that looks like it's a bomb onto the logic board, onto the, this firmware chip. It has this little 9-volt battery attachment to, so you attach the battery to it. I guess you power it on. I mean, the instructions are on the website. You can read it for yourself, and it will reset the firmware password somehow. And it worked. So we bought the thing. I think I can buy like a one use, like single use model. You can buy one with 2 licenses or 5 licenses. It's possible to buy more licenses later. So you can actually, it's like a code you type into the thing later to add a license. So you can purchase a standalone license later. So I bought one with 2 licenses on it. So I figured if it works, we've now got this tool in our toolkit for clients in the future, potentially. I mean, that's a real heroic thing, right? The computer's locked and there's no way around it. And you've got this specialized tool to reset it. Like, I just can imagine that really coming to save somebody at some point. You just buy the thing. It's $140 for the single use license and it works.
Parts and materials, this MacBook Pro cost you about $3,000 is what this boils down to.
Right. If we had to pay for labor at full, our full rate, then yeah, it would have been a complete nightmare.
You know, I'm just giving you a hard time, Joe Saponari.
Yeah,
you know,
no, of course.
Nobody spins a yarn like you. It's amazing. That Nate, he's one crackerjack.
Yeah.
He's a whiz kid.
He is a whiz kid. He's awesome. And he had a little emoji party to celebrate in our ticketing system here when finally hit party and streamers and present and balloon. And so all these happy emojis. This is like a heroic thing. Like, this computer you could practically write off, throw it away, is now working perfectly. So here's what it took. It was the keyboard. So it's $24 for the keyboard. It's really cheap if you're not buying the whole top case. $6 for the keyboard screws, those 50 screws. It sounds like a complete nightmare. The display assembly was like, I forget what I paid. I think through iFixit, like around $300 or something like that. That was the biggest cost. Then the EFI unlock tool, we paid $160 for the 2 licenses. Altogether, that's still way less than the fair market value of this computer. And including what we paid for the used, non-working computer, basically, we still made out well in this deal.
Sam's thinking to himself, where do I sign up for this? Right, Sam?
And I know where to go.
This is right up your alley, doing these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So speaking of repairs, especially with the Retinas, the MacBook Pros, have you seen the delaminating screens that are out there? So sometimes you'll get a Mac in from a client, a MacBook Pro, and it'll look like they just did something really wacky to the screen, like they put some crazy solvent on there. The actual display, the technical term is it's delaminating, but from the inside out almost. Hmm. It's like the protective covering is peeling off on the outside of the screen. And so this is something that I believe is a silent recall from Apple. So if you bring it into the store and you're really nice and you say, hey, I think this is one of those Macs that's delaminating, they will replace the screen for you, usually at no charge.
Really?
Yeah. Once you see it, I mean, you'll never forget what those Macs look like. And I'm surprised you guys haven't seen those come across your bench.
Have you seen more than...
Two, yeah. I had one where the client had some problems with a MacBook, believe it or not, a MacBook 15-inch Retina that they just gave to us, and that had a delaminating screen. That was replaced for free. And then we have a client that came in the other day, and I gave them the heads up on that. And you could actually find this online. There's a whole, you can find anything online, even things to reset the EFI password. It's amazing.
So I mentioned the iCloud issue with email addresses starting with a number. Another Apple ID thing just to be aware of, which I bumped into recently, according to Apple's Knowledge Base article on the Apple ID, a two-factor authentication, it's not possible to turn off two-factor authentication on some Apple IDs created as of iOS 10.3 or macOS 10.12.4.
I saw that.
Yeah. So that's one. It's just like you bump into it and you're like, what? And then you Google around a little bit and it's like, oh, okay. I guess that's a thing. So, and there's a little bit more info, which is apparently, like, I guess iOS 10.3 or macOS 10.12.4 and later, some Apple IDs created in those OS versions are protected with two-factor authentication by default. And in that case, I think those are the ones that where you basically cannot turn off two-factor. I'm not sure if that's connected, but you can read the article and kind of draw your own conclusions. It's a little bit strange, but is it something that Apple implemented and then like walked back, but it's the case for those IDs? Like, if you had created it on those versions, that it's not possible to turn off?
Wait, so you're saying they walked it back, meaning it is now possible?
Well, no, like in other words, the wording here is a little unclear. Like I'm not sure if it's 10.3. I guess it is ever since iOS 10.3 and macOS Sierra 10.12.4 and later. So I guess they haven't walked it back necessarily, but they're saying some accounts created. So I'm not sure if it's like every account and they're just, you know, hedging that, or if it's, why would it be the case for some accounts and not others? I don't understand that.
I don't know either, but it caught me by surprise as well, because we were doing a bunch of iPads set up for this university that I've talked about before. We set up some iPads for them. And what we'll sometimes do, because people are coming from outside the US, is for the purposes of the class, we'll create a US-based Apple ID so that they can have some access to some of the tools we provide. So Matt was creating some Apple IDs directly on the devices. And he's like, oh, I have to put two factors. So he entered his phone number for two factor. And then he goes to log in later to take it off. And there's just no possible way of removing his phone number from two factor authentication.
Oh, man. And
so he's like, what do I do? I'm like, well, you can't use those Apple IDs because they can't be all using your phone number for.
Right.
Yeah, we had to start again using hosted email addresses from their domain, because we started with iCloud.com and that's how it all went down.
Gotcha. So right. So rather than creating the iCloud.com address, you had to use their own email address as the Apple ID. But then you had to create email addresses, right? Because probably some of those people actually already had an iCloud account or Apple ID with those addresses. So you had to.
It's temporary anyway for the program that they're in. It's either 2 to 4 weeks, but still it's a pain, because we had to create email addresses, then go and create the Apple IDs based off those email addresses. It was just a little bit easier to start right from the device.
Right.
But I did not see that one coming. I was not aware of it.
Interesting. So I guess what that is implying is, like, for all accounts, or I don't know what the sum is, but in, you know, the latest versions of the Mac OS and iOS, if you create the Apple ID using the device, it's got two-factor turned on by default, and that's all there is to it.
Maybe their sum is just like an out because they know it's not perfect yet, like it's not working perfectly yet.
Right.
So they're saying some because it might not. But yeah, when we saw it, it happened to every device.
Or I wonder if it's like, if you don't include, because you can create one without including a recovery address, right? So if you don't include a recovery address, then it probably wouldn't turn on two-factor, because you'd have no way of, you need a recovery address to turn on two-factor.
Or a trusted phone number, right?
Right. So if you can somehow create an Apple ID without putting in either of those, then maybe that's the exception. That's why they say some, just speculating.
Yeah, but it is odd, the sum that it's in there. So we are both speculating, trying to figure out why.
Well, Apple does tend to hedge things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're just like, well, we can say some. That might mean all, right?
Yeah, you can see some guy at the keyboard just writing this K-based article going, yeah, some. That looks good. I'll throw that in.
Right. I'm not sure if it's all. So, yeah.
Thank you for the PSAs, Joe. You're always good with either a quiz or a PSA. I love it.
Right. It's my specialty.
I ran into a VMware issue just the other night. We were helping someone set up VMware remotely on their home computer, because he works at one of our clients during the day and he wanted this set up on his home. So, you know, Windows, we had this purchase through our vendor. They gave him a USB key with the installer, which VMware would not see, at least no way that I could find it. You had to either download or create an ISO file for VMware Fusion to then see that installer. So the USB key did us no good. We were able to download an ISO file, a valid one from Microsoft. And we went ahead and proceeded with the installation. We got an error pretty early on in the install that simply said the unattend answer file contains an invalid product key. Now, if you've ever installed Windows 10 in VMware, right at the outset, you put in information along with the product key and choose your Windows version and then proceed with the install. So I thought, all right, maybe he jotted down the product key wrong since we were remote. So we tried it again, didn't do it. We tried to download another ISO file, same deal. We could not get around this. It was saying it was invalid. So I'm looking, using my Google Foo to try and find something out there. And I finally found it, which was the oddest thing. So we could not proceed whatsoever. I think it was on VMware's site that they said, because you know how you can connect to USB devices from VMware, it said to uncheck the floppy drive from the settings. So if you go to the settings of the virtual machine, you have an option to use a floppy. I don't know anyone that does, but
yay, Windows.
I was like, this is never going to work, right? That's just crazy. So you can't uncheck the option to use the floppy drive in settings unless the virtual machine is actually running, which every time we ran it, we would get this error. So I had to get this timing right where I would launch it, go into settings, and then uncheck floppy, and I was able to catch it before the error popped up. I rebooted the virtual machine, proceeded with the installation, and lo and behold, it actually worked. Wow. And it went through the entire install. But I would never have guessed that that would have been my answer to this particular problem.
So you had to do a little whack-a-mole kind of thing.
Yeah,
you had to get in there quick.
Yeah. Uncheck that box because it's grayed out until I start the virtual machine. And I'm like, okay, got it. And then the error like would come up if I didn't catch it in time. So it took me a couple of tries. Yeah, that was kind of odd. I mean, removing the floppy from the virtual machine, who knew?
That is wild. Yeah. That's not the kind of thing. Were you doing that remotely? Because I'm thinking like that would be hard to get the timing right if you're doing that remotely.
Yeah, it was a solid connection, but yeah, it was remote.
Wow.
So using VMware remotely is could get dicey, but we were okay.
It's like Inception. It's like a computer within a computer within a computer or something like that.
Great movie.
I watched it on the plane. I was traveling and getting some plane sleep. So like 20 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and I'm watching that movie. And so I'm like, I was like in the movie at one point because I just was like, yeah, that was wild.
Yeah, because part of that does take place on a plane too, right, like where exactly. The guy falls asleep.
That's right.
Hey man, this is my PSA. If you haven't seen Inception, go see it.
Totem? Was it a Totem?
I haven't seen Inception.
A Totem, yes. Yeah. Any Christopher Nolan movie is high marks in my book. So see Inception, see The Prestige. That's another amazing movie.
Yeah, I hadn't seen Inception either, and it was just available on the plane, so I thought this is a great time to see it. I mean, I know it's one of those things you really want to see on the big screen if possible, but I saw it on a little 5-inch set, whatever it was, like airplane monitor, so... It was still good. I mean, it's a great movie.
Do you want to tell me about something you like, Joe?
Well, I think the thing I like above everything else these days is our good friend Watchman Monitoring. I just can't get enough of it. You know, I've been spending a lot more time in Watchman, doing a lot more things with running reports, exporting CSV files, showing machine status for a given client. There are great reports that client-facing reports. I just can't get enough of Watchman. I think it would be good to talk a little bit about Watchman Monitoring and what it does.
So that's a great point, Joe. What is Watchman Monitoring? Well, for those few people that are listening that don't know, it's a lightweight client that you could use as a Mac admin, whether you've got your own private practice or you're working for a larger institution, and it runs on every single client machine. What does it do? It monitors server software. It monitors your backup systems. It looks at disk drives. It looks at RAID systems. It looks at network performance. It looks at system performance. It will give you notifications when there's malware on a machine. And you can also get these reports that Joe just mentioned, these great demographic reports that you can either print out for your own organization or for your client. One of the great things that you could do with Watchman is to link it to other key apps in your workflow. We integrate it with Zendesk. And so anytime we have a notification from Watchman, it goes right into our Zendesk box, and we're able to send out a missive to our client, immediately notifying them that some action needs to be taken place, whether it's I/O errors on a hard drive and to schedule an appointment for a repair, or it's something as simple as like telling them to download Malwarebytes and attempt to remove some malware from their machine. So it's a great source for you to just stay on the pulse of what your client machines are doing. It's so versatile that you could run a very large organization single-handedly.
A lot of what you're talking about, Jerry, is proactive support. It allows us as consultants to be proactive with our clients. But on the flip side, it also allows our clients to be proactive with us. I mean, just the contact menu alone, allowing for our custom branded contact menu in the menu bar, allows them to email support directly, start a remote support session using something like TeamViewer or BombGar. And we can customize that menu with literally everything that we want. So you mentioned Zendesk. We can have that email automatically generate a Zendesk ticket for us so that we're alerted to anything that the client needs. And all this comes in a customized branded tool for our end users. So they always see our logo and our name there, showing them that we are responsible and we are maintaining their computers. And let's not forget about Watchman's provider locator that's right on their website. This allows customers to actually find consultants like us that support Watchman.
If this sounds too good to be true, kickstart it. You can sign up for a 30-day trial. You don't even have to put in your credit card by going to watchmanmonitoring.com/CCP. Start your risk-free trial. Setup only takes as little as 60 seconds, and you'll thank us that you did. It's money in the bank.
A bunch of shows ago, this was months ago, I talked about the option return override that you had as an administrator to log in to a standard user's account. I don't know if you recall this,
yeah,
but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the login screen, sure.
Right. And I was talking it up, and then we found out it wasn't working anymore in Sierra right when I was talking about it.
Right.
So I'm happy to say that it is back. I think it was as of 10.12.5. And I didn't find any documentation. I was just able to test after the latest update, and I can get back in now. So I will re-put that in our show notes, because I think that's an awesome, handy little tool to be able to override a login when someone's left their computer.
I was just thinking about how ATP, Accidental Tech Podcast, we're talking about how, you know, Apple might put the Touch ID sensor on the back of the new iPhone because the display may go edge to edge, and, you know, they'll have less of a bezel and they won't have room for a Touch ID sensor with the home button on the front and all this stuff. So they might have a Touch ID sensor on the back. And like, oh, that's going to be too confusing for people. They don't know where it is and how to find it and stuff. But, and then the other idea was like, it could be on screen. Like it could be somehow part of the display. If they could make that work, that would be pretty amazing. And it just occurred to me, like, clients get so confused with the way it is now. You know, when they're setting up Touch ID, especially, I mean, really mainly for the setup, but I've had other cases too, like with Apple Pay, and they get really confused. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but like when you're walking a client through initially setting up Touch ID, they're baffled because they see the picture of the fingerprint on screen and they're like touching the screen, you know, and then when they're supposed to be just placing their finger on the home button, they're pressing it. They just get all confused about that. I don't know. Maybe I have a certain kind of client, but do you guys ever have clients with that kind of level of confusion? No,
I'm sure we can all agree with that, right, Jerry?
Absolutely. No, you're pressing it too hard. No. Right. Now you shut it off. Now it's off.
That's off.
Okay. Yeah. Now you have to unlock the screen. Okay. There you go. Okay. Now press it. Go ahead. Press it again. No.
Right.
No, that's not it. Yeah. And absolutely.
They're leaving their finger there and you're like, okay, no, pick it up. No. Yeah. Now place it back down again. It's like, you know, it's like this thing where you're like telling them every step of the way and they're just so confused about it. And I think part of it is like the fact that the Touch ID sensor is like abstracted away from the screen. The screen is in one place, you know, with the picture of what they're supposed to do. And then down below the screen in this other area, there's like a little sensor and they're supposed to know that that's the sensor. They get very confused about it. So it would be really cool if it could just be on screen somewhere. And like then the screen is like showing you what to do, where to do it. So I don't know. That was just a little observation I had. It would probably help at least the setup process quite a bit, but probably make the whole thing a little bit easier for people actually. So I don't know. I'd be a fan of that.
You're bullish on it.
Yeah, on that. Exactly. If they can make that work, putting it on screen, I think is kind of a stretch, but that's just the sort of impressive thing that they would do for something like the 10th anniversary iPhone. So if it's possible somehow.
I felt like one of my clients recently. I was sitting on the couch with my wife on my computer, as I sometimes do in front of the TV. So I'm working away on my computer, and all of a sudden, as I'm typing, you know, I'm typing email, and all of a sudden, just like an A and an E just start typing across my screen. What the hell is going on? So quit out of mail, I come back in, still happening. I reboot the computer, different letters are appearing on the screen. And then at my login window, it's just going, you know, like it's trying to type. And I'm freaking out. I'm like, okay, I got a haunted computer. And I'm like, who do I call? I totally felt like a client just sitting there going, I don't know what to do about this. And I'm showing my wife and I'm like, what the hell is going on here? She's like, I don't know. That's the weirdest thing ever.
I what? Know. What's Hokey that? Was sitting on the Apple remote.
Hokey. The dog's name is Loki, Jerry.
that makes a difference.
You were very close.
Excuse me. Loki.
In my office, about 20 feet away, my daughter was working at my desk and put her laptop on the edge of my keyboard, my Bluetooth keyboard. So it was, you know, displaying input on my Mac while I was trying to work. And I freaked out until I immediately, like after the reboot and I started seeing it, I go, oh, and I ran over to my office. I'm like, get that laptop off my keyboard. And I finally That's figured good. It out, but it was hysterical at the time. I mean, just watching it going, I don't know what to do here. What's wrong?
Yeah, that's a classic. Accidental input or the mouse won't click. Well, there's a wireless mouse in the drawer and there's a book on it or whatever, you know, and it's like holding down the button. You can really blow somebody's mind when you hit that nail on the head with that. You're a genius, you know, because it's like, what else would it be? You know, that's a good one. What are you guys recommending for antivirus? Or maybe we put this out to the listeners. What are listeners recommending for antivirus?
Mac Keeper.
Of course.
I had to come.
It goes without saying. Yeah, it's definitely Mac Keeper. Well, I mean, speaking of like malware type stuff, this has been killing me lately. I've had this happen like 3 times and I've only been able to fix it once up until today when it happened the third time. And so let me start over. So I've seen this situation where malware changes the homepage in Safari. You end up with Lackey search or whatever. So I forget what it's called. Loki search. No, it's something like that though. It's like
Hokey search.
It's Linky. It's like Linky Mac search or something like that. So it changes your homepage. We've all seen this before. So you remove the malware. I use Malwarebytes, remove the malware. And first, usually I'll go through and just manually scan for stuff and remove stuff manually. So a combination of the two, and I remove all traces of malware, and then I go into Safari. Final step is to check for any extensions and make sure the search is set correctly to Google for most people, and hasn't been changed to Bing or something like that, and check the homepage. And it's the homepage that has been getting stuck for me on a few of these, and I don't know which malware it is that's doing this, but because it's usually like several, but you go into Safari preferences. General on the homepage field there, and it's set to like linky.com or whatever. I forget exactly what it was, like Linky Mac search or something like that. And you just, okay, quickly type in, google.com and hit enter, and it just changes back to this Linky thing. All right, let's try apple.com. Nope, changes right back. You open up a new tab, you visit a page like google.com, and then you go to the preferences and you say set to current page. Doesn't work, doesn't have any effect. It's stuck on this Linky thing. This has happened, like I said, about 3 times. And the first time it happened, I can't remember. I think it was something like the preference file was locked or something like that. It's something that I worked around and it was fine. The second time, ran out of time troubleshooting it. And it was one of these rare things where I'm like, I don't know, I'm stumped. And they're like, well, I don't really use Safari anyway, so blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all right, fine. So I just let it go. This time I was like determined to figure it out. I hit a wall at one point, but then last ditch I said, let's do a safe boot. So I walked the client remotely through a safe boot, got it through that process. They got logged back in. They're still in a safe boot, had them open up Safari and change the homepage. And sure enough, it worked fine. Okay, that's weird. So then I have them quit and reopen Safari. Sure enough, the change stuck. It's fine. It changed successfully. Had them restart normally, no safe boot, and go back into Safari. And sure enough, they can change the homepage. Part of me wants to say like safe boot fixed it. Maybe it was something in our good old friend var folders, because that's one of the things, I can't remember which one, it's the temporary directory, I think, that gets cleared out, or maybe the cache portion of var folders that gets cleared out on a safe boot. Maybe that fixed it, or maybe it was something like an application that was running that I didn't realize was running after I restarted. So I cleared the malware, I restarted. Maybe something was running, of course, I restarted. And it still wouldn't let me change the homepage. So that's why I was stumped. I was pretty confident I removed any trace of malware and restarted, and it was still not working. So all I can think of is after I restarted, some application reopened automatically or something. It took another restart after quitting. There was this one backup application, some cagey looking thing that he said had been there for a long time. So I didn't think it was related to this issue, but maybe that was what was causing it. Once I quit it, maybe I had to restart again. Baffling to me. So if anybody's encountered this problem where you can't change the homepage in Safari after a malware infestation or infection, I'd love to know like what worked for you definitively, or if the safe boot works for you, like seemed to work for me. I feel like that's one that's going to get worse over time, because it's been happening lately. I'd be interested to know which malware seems to be responsible for it, and what your fix is, if any. So we were at the ACES conference last month. I was sitting, I think, 2 or 3 seats over from Ryan Grimes. And Jerry, you, I think, sent me in our shared messages thread, hey, check this Wattbox thing out, recommended by Ryan. This is actually perfect timing. I've been researching remote reboot power switches. And the last time I researched this a few years ago, there were very few to choose from that were in my price range. There was one I found for like $100-$150 or so that has 2 outlets, and I was thinking about it, and I thought, what would I plug into it? And 2 is kind of limiting, and it's not cheap, and, is it going to be reliable? And all these questions, and I just never did it. And then recently, I had this issue in between 2 trips where the power went out. My servers didn't reboot, including my mail server, so our email server was down for like a day. Luckily, it was on the Memorial Day holiday, and I was able to get it and boot it back up. Anyway, I thought, you know, I really need a remote reboot option here, not only for things like that, but just if something's malfunctioning. I mean, you know all the reasons why this would be helpful. The one I had identified was not inexpensive, had, I think, 8 outlets, and it was on Amazon. There was one in stock on Amazon, and I thought, this is a little bit sketchy. Like, I don't know if this is going to work out. And so your recommendation from Ryan was perfectly timed, and I was ready to just sort of dive in. Jerry, how would you advise listeners order these? Because it was not easy to order directly.
Well, Ryan was a dealer, and it's as simple as just signing up to be a seller of this product. And we'll put this exactly in the show notes where you need to go. And then you get your dealer pricing, and you can theoretically mark it up to full retail for your client when you resell this. But you get a dealer discount.
Okay. So you basically, you just sign up, you know, as a dealer if you want to buy it even for yourself initially.
Yeah, there's no commitment, there's no sign-up fee, and you just show that you're a bona fide business, and they'd be happy to have you be a distributor of this product. And they also make other networking products. They make gateways, and they make all kinds of power management products as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they have UPS units that work with or are compatible with the Wattbox. You know, the device we're talking about is called the Wattbox. There's lots of versions of it, and it's a remote reboot power switch or power distribution unit. Very flexible things. They make IP cameras, racks, and all kinds of stuff that they sell. And this is all for sale on onisle8.com is the link. And we'll put that in the show notes at commandcontrolpower.com. This looked like a really good option because compared with the one that I was looking at on Amazon, this was the one I was looking at was a CyberPower. I didn't have personal recommendations to go on. I wasn't too sure about it. And, you know, based on Ryan's experience and my research, this looked like a great option. So I pulled the trigger right away on this Wattbox 12-port unit. Finally, just had a chance to set it up. I had plugged it in a couple weeks ago, and just last weekend, actually configured it and set it up. And it was really easy to do, really easy to find on the network, really easy to configure. They make this remote access site available. You don't need to sort of like open up any ports in your network to reach it. The interface is really nice, and they have an app as well. So not only a web interface, but an app. So initial impression, easy to set up and really great interface for configuring it.
There's two separate apps that they offer, and you can see how that works at ovrc.com. And that's the actual branded technology that integrates with the Wattbox. And so you as an integrator can use this iPhone app, and you could see all your installations of Wattbox and have full control over rebooting individual outlets or rebooting the whole device. But there's an app that your client can download at each location specifically, and you can program certain actions for them to do. So if you just want to give them a button to power cycle the modem, you can create that in the account, and they log into their app, and that's all they have access to. There's also a place for you to put your company logo, and they can also send you an email right directly from that app. Like, hey, you know, we're having some trouble. Can you check this out? It's really slick stuff, and it's very much designed for what we do.
When you guys first started talking about it, I didn't think I had a need for it initially in my home office, but now I'm thinking in terms of the client sites where I could use this and some places that have had some power issues as of late. Have you guys just had these in your offices so far, or have started to deploy them elsewhere in your clients?
I put them out to one site so far. I haven't gotten the rack mounted switch. So in my own office, I have a 3-port running on one floor and then a 5-port running on another floor. I'm just a sucker for really slick gadgets. And the price point wise was really, really good. And when you first sign up, they actually give you a discount on your second order. So I was paying less than $150 for one of these. And it's also a power conditioner too. So, and it's designed to run right off your uninterruptible power supply. So if you bought the OnIL8 power supply, it could actually talk to the Wattbox, but I don't have those. But you can actually plug this device and basically use it right from your uninterruptible power supply, and that's how it's designed to work. I've deployed it in one educational site right now where we've constantly had problems or kind of in a rural setting, and sometimes you don't know whether the gateway's gone down or the modem just needs to be power cycled, and it gives me complete hands-on control no matter where I am in the world. So I'm pretty excited about it.
It's a really great product. It's one of those things like backup, just having your client's data being backed up in general. That's also a feature for us. It's like peace of mind for us as the consultant. There are lots of cases in regards to backup where clients like seemingly don't care. If they don't care, you might say, well, we don't care. But a good consultant, I think, cares, right? That we might get that call unexpectedly that they've lost data. And so we want them to have a backup. And that's for our peace of mind as much as their own. same thing here. Like if something should happen, and like you said, Jerry, in your case, it's maybe a rural area. You don't want to drive out there necessarily to troubleshoot. Well, let's try and reboot this device. Let's try and reboot this device. You just might want to have that control. It's fine sometimes to walk a client through, okay, what do you see? Is there a red light on there? Walking them through identifying which device you want them to unplug. You know, do you see the Apple logo on the top? Okay. No, not that other, you know, device that's, you know, going to take the whole network down. We just want you to unplug the power on the Mac Mini. You know, that kind of thing. And you can do that, you know, yourself remotely without having to walk somebody through that and have that messy kind of experience.
And could you just take us through, Joe, how the software works with pinging certain websites, what the science behind how the Wattbox works?
Not only do you have the ability to just manually turn off an outlet and turn it back on, you can reset an outlet. So in the case of like a router, for example, you don't want to just turn off the router. You want to click a button to actually turn off and turn back on the router. Because as soon as you click the button to turn off the router, you lose access to the Wattbox and you can't turn it back on. So they have this, you know, concept of, you know, off, on, and then of course reset. Before I get into the sort of automatic features, one of the nice things I like about that on-off reset feature is that you can label certain equipment as reset only. And what that does is it, in the interface, it only gives you the option to reset the outlet in particular. So you have like, on mine, I have these 12 outlets, you know, one is the modem, two is the router, three is the cellular modem, let's say, and you go down the list. Now, those three, you can only reset. I don't have like an off switch, because if I clicked off on the router, I'd have to drive here and physically reboot that device. Otherwise, the Wattbox itself would be offline and I wouldn't be able to like turn that outlet back on remotely, right?
That's right. Game over.
Right.
So turn it off. Yeah.
That's the don't let me shoot myself in the foot kind of option. So you have this like reset only kind of option. But yeah, in addition to those manual controls, which are great in and of themselves, you mentioned, Jerry, they have this feature where the Wattbox can automatically ping certain either websites or devices, URLs or IP addresses that you specify and then take action based on, you know, what happens. So the way I have mine configured is, well, first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about my network. So I have a WAN 1 and WAN 2 going into a Zywall USG 200. And WAN 1 is the cable modem. So that's our primary internet connection. WAN 2 is a cellular modem. If this cable modem goes down, the Zywall is configured to automatically fail over to WAN 2, to the cellular, if it times out. And the way that that's configured, I think this is the default. It's like, it allows for a 5-second timeout. So if it gets no response in 5 seconds, it considers that a timeout. If it does that 5 times in a row, then it will fail over. It checks the address. In this case, it's checking 8.8.8.8, so Google's DNS server. If Google's DNS server is down, we have big problems. And so it will then, you know, wait 30 seconds, try again. If it's still down 5 times, it will fail over to WAN 2. Now the Wattbox, what that does is it will automatically reboot the cable modem and the cellular modem if they're down for 5 minutes, if basically the WAN connection is down. So the Wattbox is getting its connection from the main router, which has failover built in. If the cable modem goes down, the Zywall waits until a certain amount of time goes by. If it's still down, it fails over to the cellular modem. It tries to do that. If it's still down a couple minutes later, the Wattbox will automatically power cycle both the cable modem and the cellular modem. So if for some reason, like let's say the cellular modem is just offline for whatever reason, and the Zywall tries to fail over to the cellular modem, and now basically neither internet connection is working, the Wattbox will then automatically reboot both the cable modem and the cellular modem.
And the thing about the Wattbox too is you could set it so it'll keep on cycling itself infinitely until it gets a WAN, it gets successful WAN pings.
Exactly. So if it's down for 5 minutes, it reboots both devices. It will then check again, I think, after waiting 10 minutes. And if it's still, you know, if it's down again after 10 more minutes, it will do that again. And in my case, I think the default, and I went with this, it'll reboot up to 5 times. But like you said, you can actually just let it go on indefinitely. If you set that setting to 0, basically that just means infinite. It'll just keep power cycling everything until finally, you know, the connections come back online. By default, it will check Google, Bing, and ask.com. The theory there is all three of those search engines are down. That probably means the internet is down. You know, they have different enough infrastructure and they're, you know, hosted in different places where if all three of those are down, essentially our connection is offline. And you can set it to say, like, if any of these, you know, multiple choices are down, that's considered offline. Essentially, if you want to detect for WAN connection in general, then you go with, you know, if all three of these major search engines are down, then we consider like essentially the internet is offline. There's also by default the router IP address in there. So whatever gateway it picks up by DHCP or whatever you specify in the initial setup, it adds that as an IP address to check to see if it can get a response from your router, for example. But you don't want a response from the router to override that auto reboot feature. And I think, Jerry, you kind of clarified this with Wattbox. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, they said to remove the gateway in general. It's really not good policy to have it in there at all. Setup is really easy. Sounds fairly sophisticated what we're talking about. Also, too, you can do just real simple programming routines. You could say reboot the modem every 7 days. Yeah. So that's kind of cool, too.
Yeah, the schedules. I'm using that actually myself for the time capsule. So I'm still backing up a few machines in my office to a time capsule. And like clockwork, that time capsule just kind of gets frozen about once a week. So I was, you know, manually just trying to remember to reboot it. It wouldn't actually go orange or it wouldn't start blinking or anything. It would just stay green, but it wasn't possible to back up. So I found a power cycling, it would just let it keep working. Instead of having to remember to do that myself, I just scheduled the Wattbox to do that. Every Sunday at 5 a.m. or whatever, it just power cycles the time capsule. Probably no machines are in the middle of a backup at that time, you know, and if they are, maybe it was frozen anyway. So it reboots weekly. And I just found that that was a fine solution for right now.
Yeah, it's really worth the money. I love their byline, or their slogan is, don't roll a truck, pull the plug remotely.
Right. It's a great slogan. On the topic of the router IP address, in my case, I actually added back in my router IP address, and I have a separate auto reboot routine. So if all three search engines fail and the router fails, then it reboots the router. If just the three search engines are offline, it just reboots the two modems. Because there are cases, like if the router doesn't respond, you know, you might want to power cycle the router. But right. if the router's responding and you're not getting any search engines, that doesn't mean you're online. So I basically excluded the router from the reboot in the case of being offline. But if the router is offline and the search engines are offline, I also want to reboot the router. So it's really flexible. You can, and that's not, doesn't take a lot to sort of set that up. That's pretty quick.
Okay, I want one.
It's very cool. Now, I thought 12 outlets would be plenty of room for expansion. I thought, okay, you know, what modem, router, like what else do I need? So I'm actually using 11 out of 12 outlets already, and I feel like I need like two more because I have like my internal LAN switch. I have my client network LAN switch. I have like my VoIP phone switch, my, you know, security, you know, PoE switch. You know, the more I thought about it, I'm like, which one of these would I take out of the loop? I really would like the ability to power cycle any of these things. Or for that matter, if the power goes out and we're on battery power, I might want to turn off, you know, certain things and leave them off until the power comes back on. So it's just nice to have that capability. So yeah, I could use a second one of these.
Thanks again to Watchman Monitoring for sponsoring this episode of Command Control Power. Go to watchmanmonitoring.com/CCP and you could start your 30-day free trial.